Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, November 9th, 2013. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. We're going to have a very important discussion on the program today because we're going to start with some things that most of you are just not aware of. And that is that after the president was forced to back down from the intent to bomb Syria, which would have put us on the verge of thermonuclear war, he did back down, but he's not changed the policy. The intention of the people who control Obama, namely the Anglo-Dutch Saudi Empire, is still to go for provocations that could lead to thermonuclear war. And while the U.S. military is acutely aware of this, for example, General Dempsey, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who played a leading role in marching us back from war over Syria, is still very concerned, and the U.S. military is warning about the forward deployment under Obama of U.S. and NATO forces. And this has come to a head in the last week in that you had a report in the Washington Post of the Chinese deployment, that the Chinese are acknowledging that they have an asymmetric nuclear response capability from their submarine fleet that can hit the whole United States. And while some people initially tried to portray this as Chinese warmongering, the Chinese government said, no, we're just trying to be more transparent. But the fact is that the Chinese are putting this out. At the same time, the Russians are conducting over and over what they call snap exercises, that is, unscheduled military maneuvers, with President Putin present at them. The Chinese and the Russians have upgraded their cooperation. And so many people may think, well, Russia and China, are they going for war or what? Well, look at the reality. You still have the commitment of the United States and NATO for forward deployment of anti-ballistic missile systems, supposedly to protect against Iranian nukes, but actually directed against Russia. You have the air-sea-land battle policy in Asia, which is directed at China. You have the discussion underway with the president or the prime minister of Japan, Abe, of rearming Japan, including the possibility of nuclear weapons. And you have both against Russia and China a deployment of terrorism, including Chechen terrorists in Dagestan, threats from Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia that these terrorists might hit the Winter Olympics, and you had unprecedented a bomb attack in a regional capital outside of Beijing several days ago, and last weekend you had a terrorist incident from the so-called Uyghur separatists, the Muslim separatist movement funded by the Saudis against the Chinese that actually targeted very close to where the president of China was engaged in a meeting. So you have this kind of forward deployment and threat against Russia and China coming from the Anglo-Saudi forces that run the president of the United States. Now, adding to that was a BBC report just 2 days ago that the Saudis may activate their access to Pakistani nuclear weapons. And this comes at a point where the Saudis are making threats that if the U.S. does not allow the bombing of Syria on behalf of the Saudi-backed rebels, and if the U.S. Does not move against Iran, the Saudis or the Israelis will. And so you have the Saudi-Israeli axis working together under an Anglo, a British direction, with Obama backing it up. Now, this is causing a great deal of reaction within the U.S. institutions. But I want to just highlight the other side of this, which is that we just had a major conference, another one of the New Paradigm conferences sponsored by the Schiller Institute. We had a conference in Los Angeles last weekend, or was it 2 weekends ago? I'm losing track of time right now. No, it was last weekend, which brought together people from Asia, from the Asian community in the Los Angeles area, and LaRouche activists and new contacts to have a very profound and deep discussion of the great potential for collaboration and development using Lyndon LaRouche's Go West approach, the CUSA project, of linking the United States with Asia through the Bering Strait Tunnel and other great development projects. Based on this idea that China, Russia, and the United States are natural allies, and in fact, you could add to that, so is Germany, except that the European situation has been so distorted by the British domination, especially through the European Union. So I took a little extra time with this introduction because many of our listeners are just not aware of this reality, how close we are to thermonuclear war, how dangerous this situation is as long as Barack Obama remains in the presidency. And so joining us on the program today will be Lainey Rubinstein, who is the EIR correspondent at the United Nations and someone who has been in China, has traveled to China, has delivered presentations in China as well as to various Chinese communities in the United States, and she knows the situation from the inside. And also joining us from Germany is Tony Kaestner, who is, as he just informed me, the CEO of the Fusion Energy Foundation in Germany and one of the young activists in the LaRouche movement in Germany. And so we'll be talking to the two of them about this crisis under the general heading thermonuclear war or thermonuclear development. So Lainey and Tony, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Holly.
Thank you.
Lainey, let's just start with you. The conference that just concluded, I think, was a potentially powerful antidote to the usual discussion about the threat from China, the lamentable situation we find ourselves in where China is exporting to the United States to make up for the shutdown of our manufacturing economy, and then the Chinese, as a result of that, are dependent on U.S. dollars. Instead, we talked about physical economy. Why don't you just, from your vantage point, give a summary of the significance of this conference?
Well, I think the point was made very clear by Lyndon and Helga LaRouche that kind of set the stage for the conference, where they would go through what Harley just developed, or the tremendous danger that is facing mankind with the danger of war and financial collapse, which goes hand in hand. And as Helga LaRouche said, the world is hanging by a thread. And then what the entire conference did was to have the antidote to that. As Michael Steger from the policy committee said, this conference is about the future. And the question, I mean, I think also a very important point was that the Chinese leaders, an economist who has been knowing LaRouche for the last 10, 15 years, he met the organization here in the United States, and now he's back in China, Mr. Ding Yifeng, who is the deputy director for a major think tank that works under the State Council, which is the government of China. He presented a 10-minute video address to the conference, in which he said how China had changed from development of the coastal areas and now knew that they had to develop the interior of China, and that LaRouche had called for the building of a Eurasian land bridge, or a development corridor spanning from the eastern part of China and going through Eurasia into Europe, and how there was three bridges, these land bridges covering the entire area, and how people didn't listen to what LaRouche had to say, but he was right. And now, years later, where LaRouche had laid this out first beginning in the 1990s, now the president of China, Xi Jinping, indeed is pursuing that policy which was laid out by Xi Jinping in October last month when at the meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation countries. So that was, I really think that between Lyndon and Helga LaRouche and then Mr. Ding, saying LaRouche was right. He's developing ideas long before people really understand what he's talking about, and he always turns out to be right. And from that point on, the entire 12-hour conference had, it was like a symphony of different, with different instruments and voices coming in from Thailand, from the Philippines, scientists in the United States.
Yeah, Lainey, I think this participation from Asia was somewhat unique. We had done some of that with the San Francisco conference last June.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this time it gave people a much better sense, and in some cases created a little bit of uneasiness about, are we really saying the United States has no option now except to link up with Russia and China?
But also, I mean, one of the disgusting things regarding the way the oligarchies function is the brainwashing and the black propaganda regarding other nations, here in particular the Asian nations, both China, India, and Russia, and very racist too, so that people have this scare of that China is going to come and attack us, and China is a big now, what do you call it, the scare, what do you call it?
Scarecrow,
okay. Where indeed what China is doing is to a large extent now carrying out what the United States should be doing with massive in-depth infrastructure of fast-speed rail, water projects. One thing I want to point out is that when LaRouche says go west in the United States, where we have had this policy for centuries now with making a continental nation, and then go west over the Pacific, that this is where the future lies, mainly because this is half of the world's population is in that area. So that is if we combine technology and research with a massive education of people, we have a center there for an incredible development for the future that can secure mankind. And what the Chinese are doing is applying very healthy economic development principles, and their development possibilities for their country is very much to lift people out of poverty, and massive investment in in-depth development. And I want to point out one factor is that for the last, particularly the last 5 years, the Chinese have been very intense, longer, but in particular escalating in the last 5 years, the Chinese has been very intent on developing the western part of China. And that was one thing that Mr. Ding also pointed out, because when people are very poor, then it's much easier to instigate terrorism, separatism, and so forth. So they have a very conscious program for developing the western part of China, including Tibet, where in 2008 you had the railroad opening up so you can drive all the way from Shanghai up to Lhasa on the roof of the world by train. But also, it also shows how they think about their neighboring countries and their forward policy for the future. Namely, when you're developing the western part of China, you are looking beyond China. You're looking to the Central Asian nations and beyond. And it is not an isolation policy. It's the opposite of thinking about how can we collaborate with our nature for expanding these development corridors across Eurasia. So I think that's a very... They have literally invested trillions of yen in the western part of China in order to promote this process.
Well, let's look at the contrast in the transatlantic region, where we see it seems as though the purpose of the European Union is to create more poverty with the austerity policies and so on. And Tony, I'd actually like to start with something you mentioned before the program about the upgrading of U.S. military forces, nuclear forces in Germany. I mean, here we are, more than 20 years after the end of the Cold War, and yet we still have NATO, we still have this kind of threatening deployment. How do you see this from Germany?
Yeah, I guess it's the whole question to which paradigm we want to belong and where do we want to go from here. I mean, you can clearly see that with the paradigm shift in the 60s after the killing of Kennedy, it just got going a while and then it collapsed very worse. And right now, it almost seems you get a battle between Obama and the European Union who can faster kill a lot of people. I mean, we're getting this upgrading of 180 nuclear bombs that are stationed in Germany. Nobody really knows what happens. Some people see the worst. They're talking about we probably get a Cold War situation where we get thousands of nuclear bombs stationed in Germany in order to be kind of a front line against the East, against Russia and China. You had a couple of articles of that. But mostly the discussion was around, yeah, it's not a big deal, just let's not think about it. And that's kind of the general discussion here in Germany, in the
media.
The
head in the sand still, huh?
Hmm?
The head in the sand. Keep your head down and you won't get shot.
Yeah, don't hear, don't see, don't say, and everything will be good. I mean, it's the same that right now in Greece, there's a law introduced that states when a citizen criticizes the European Union, he can be put for 6 weeks into jail. I mean, that's absolutely not democratic. It's not discussed at all in the media. Now we had election for a whole month. We had no government. Actually, we not even have yet a real government. It's still in the process of discussing a grand coalition between the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats that both stated in the beginning of the elections that they will not work together. So they are totally treasonous against their voters. And now you see already the energy cost because of this renewable energy will go up. So we're now discussing about probably losing one-third of the industrial working force in the non-ferrous metalworking industries like aluminum and so on and so forth because this firm simply cannot pay the electricity bill.
I want to come back to the energy question in a moment, but I just in terms of the strategic picture that we took at the beginning, when you're out organizing in Germany, what's the view toward Russia right now? Is there hostility towards Putin? I mean, in the United States, you still have this line that Putin was KGB. You can't really trust the Russians. Although a lot of that changed with the Syria situation, where Putin turned the tables on Obama. I'm just curious, what do we find in Germany when we talk about Russia? And is Russia seen as a threat? Are people worried about the need to have nuclear weapons on German soil for protection against Russia?
Yeah, it's different. I mean, first of all, we still have this east-west split. I mean, I'm coming from East Germany. People usually looking different on Russia because they have some experience with the Russian system. Of course, they have some inkling into Putin, who lived a while in East Germany. So they're looking a little bit different on it. In the West, you generally have the tendency to looking bad to everything that's East. China is bad, Russia is bad, not really democratic. So you're having, like, already in this situation in Germany, a mixed idea about the East. But why I said the things about the general collapse is that people start realizing that you have a bad situation and there's something fishy about the argumentation from the Western nations about democracy, and then you're seeing all this intervention wars. Of course, you have the spying scandal in Germany. You're seeing this upgrading of military, and then people seeing supposedly undemocratic nations doing work in Africa, doing industry work, collaborating. So we're actually getting a sort of a grouping of people in the institutions that saying, like, why not working together with Russia? Why not looking what's going on in China? And what most people are not knowing, because it's not discussed at all, that basically the main intellectual source of Germany concerning maglev technology, concerning nuclear technologies, fission and fusion, they are all already working in China, in Asia, because that's the only nation that give them jobs and want their help in order to establish a safe future.
Right. Well, you're listening to the LaRouche Show. I'm just going to interrupt Tony for a second there to remind you This is our program for November 9th, 2013, and we're talking with Lainey Rubinstein from the Executive Intelligence Review and Tony Kestner, who's calling in from Germany. I'm not sure, are you in Essen or Stuttgart? Or?
No, I'm in North Rhine-Westphalia in Essen.
Okay, and Tony is the CEO of the Fusion Energy Foundation in Germany. Now, Lainey, just to come back to this, the broader war threat again, to what extent, from what you know, is there an understanding that the Obama administration, understanding in China, that the Obama administration is operating from this British imperial standpoint, or do they see this as an American empire? To what extent are they figuring out what Mr. LaRouche has been telling them?
I mean, LaRouche is really the key person among intellectuals that dare to think in China as representing something very special in the United States. I can give an example. I was invited to a conference last November in China, and the invitation stated explicitly, actually a couple of different locations, that they would like to have me come to speak as a representative of Lyndon LaRouche because we were non-mainstream, and they really wanted non-mainstream Americans at this conference. And that was why it was so important that I could come. So there is a problem in otherwise to really understand the difference between that U.S. to a large degree now is controlled through puppet Obama and other Wall Street and other institutions by City of London and the British-Dutch oligarchy. That is a problem. I have a proposal, though, thinking about what Tony said, and that is in 1919-1920, there was a great collaboration between the foreign minister of Germany, Walter Rathenau, and the Chinese revolutionary leader, Sun Yat-sen, based on Sun Yat-sen's program for great development programs for China and beyond. And unfortunately, Rathenau was assassinated in 1922. But I think among good Germans and good people in Europe generally, to awaken that idea again of a collaboration of Asia and Germany and Europe around those very ideas that Rathenau and Sun Yat-sen represented. And they had seminars and intense study groups where they studied the German-American economist Friedrich List as the basis for their ideas for what to do in the future. So I will just put that out to our friends over in Europe, because I think the whole idea and you know, memory and celebration of those ideas, which are more urgent now than ever, that we have a collaboration for the sake of the future of mankind. And that can only be if people have a collaboration of higher ideas in the future for mankind, which is, I think, concerning China, that's why I think it's so important with the work that we are doing, to simply give people an idea again and again and again, like what Mr. Ding at the conference last Saturday pointed out, LaRouche is normally right. People just don't understand it before long after LaRouche have said something. But now with the crisis sharpening, there is a tendency for people waking up. And one thing that the Chinese leadership and the Chinese intellectuals are extremely alert to is the preservation and the development of China. There is a tremendous optimism because China has gone through such an incredible change in the last 30 years. So they are aware of the danger and they want to develop their people to a higher living standard, do the right thing, and therefore with the crisis sharpening, I'm completely convinced that in these very days that LaRouche's ideas and proposals and warnings are being studied more than ever.
Well, and the contrast between the Trans-Pacific and the Transatlantic couldn't be more extreme. As Tony was pointing out, there seems to be a contest between Obama and the European Union as to who can kill more people. But in the United States, at least we can talk about that. But it seems as though in Germany we're able to talk more openly about it. But here's my question for you, Tony. In the elections of September 22nd, there wasn't really a clear solution in Germany. And now there's talk of a grand coalition with the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats. But it appears as though there's not really a change in policy. In fact, there's even perhaps a more aggressive stand against nuclear energy, against technology. What is the status of the talks between the CDU and the SPD, and what does that portend for Germany?
Well, I mean, we're getting very close to getting jokes back, as in the end of the GDR and the population. I mean, we recently went out on the streets and telling people, look, now the election is over, we're allowed to talk about politics again. And everybody was laughing and knowing exactly what we mean by saying that, because there was no discussion in politics at all before the election, and also after forming the Grand Coalition. There was no talk about the bail-in policy that the EU finance minister and headed by the German finance minister decided already before the election that this will become reality. They talked about the banking union. There was no discussion during the election. So it's a back and forth, and nobody trusts the party system anymore, because they're saying it's all the same. It doesn't matter if it's the Christian Democrats, if it's the Social Democrats, if it's whatever. It just doesn't matter, because they're all doing the same, because they're all supporting the system, they're all supporting the European Union. So therefore, there's nothing really I can say to your question, because everything they're discussing in the media right now in terms of party politics, everybody knows it's a lie, and the things that sound good, it will never happen. They are just set so that the population keeps the mouth shut.
And at this point, just in terms of the specifics, what that means, you were reporting earlier that the price of electricity is going up. It's not just nuclear that's being opted out of, but it appears as though there's a real move against coal and gas. So what's going to happen there? When we talk to people who are involved in science and actually understand these things, aren't people completely up in arms about the destruction of these advanced technologies in Germany?
I mean, people cannot believe it. I mean, a couple of years ago, we talked to a head of a nuclear power facility who told us he was in the 90s in Asia when Germany made the decision to drop nuclear power, and all the Asian nations said, look, you guys dropping nuclear power, that means you mastered nuclear fusion already. We know it. You would never drop nuclear power. You will never drop nuclear fission if you would not have mastered fusion. So people couldn't believe it, that an advanced society, a nation with such high standards, just drop it. And that was cultural brainwashing. Now we have this energy revolution. We have Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber, who is a British financed agent in the Science Advisory Board of our chancellor. He is quite open with his title Commander of the Order of the British Empire, who he's belonging to. And they are now saying no coal, no oil, no gas, no fission. We don't want to invest in fusion because we don't have the money for it. So everything that we have is windmills and solar panels. And now we're discovering that the energy prices get so high that we're losing all our aluminum fabrication, steel fabrication, because these firms cannot pay the electricity bill. So then we are not even able to build solar panels or windmills, because we simply don't have the steel or aluminum for it. So that shows that this whole green policy is only about the destruction of industrialized nation to bring them back in a feudal system. We have no electricity at all.
And just on that note also, I mean, you're, I'm sure, very well aware of the effects of the austerity in countries like Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal. And for a period of time, part of the EU policy seemed to be to pit Germany against Greece, with Germany being the stern, rich uncle saying to the Greeks, you don't work hard enough, and blaming the problem in Greece not on the banks, but on the people of Greece. Is that still the general sense, or are people beginning to figure out that it's the EU itself which is the problem?
I mean, more and more people seeing that, but as you probably also have seen in the media in the United States, you had this right-wing, left-wing, back and forth in Greece. Nobody talks about Spain. We don't want to talk about Italy. We don't want to talk about the refuge situation, that there were several hundred people drowning in the Mediterranean Sea because of Lampedusa. So there's all the sorts of things that are somehow in the mind of the people, but nobody talks about it. And I think the best example is, despite everything we heard in the United States about Obamacare, it's killing people, think about it, that in Europe, especially in Germany, we actually had a very, very good healthcare system until recently, and now we're discussing shutting down 3,000 hospitals. The midwives are now running berserk because you have regions where one-third of the midwives' stations in the hospitals are just canceled, and now the midwife's saying we're experiencing already a lot of death, sickness of young-born children because there's no midwives. There's nobody that simply can take care of these little kids. In Belgium, now you have a discussion about enabled doctor-assisted suicides for people under 18, kids, basically. You have the situation in the Netherlands about killing young people, like not life worth of living, so to call. I mean, they are really, really blunt in the supposedly so developed Western European nations. So you have these things, they're all going on. People are experiencing them personally, but there's no media talk about it. And I think that is a great problem, but it also gives a great potential, especially when we going out in the streets and addressing the solution, because people have all these problems in mind, but we coming out with, for example, our election campaign video, A Vision for a Future, where we're showing people that we have all the technologies, that we have all the means to get rid of poverty, to get rid of starvation, to get rid of droughts, and so on and so forth. And people actually, they're reacting quite good to this optimistic future, and by seeing the potential we have, they even overcome their greenness.
Well, I think as Lainey can tell you, Tony, I'm a great admirer of European culture. You know that, and I, as much as I love Europe, what we're actually seeing, what you just described, is 500 years later, why CUSA made the decision that the future was in the West. And Lainey, I'd like you to take this up, because Lynn, in his presentation in Los Angeles, Lyndon LaRouche, brought up again this question of the CUSA project, that at a point at which the situation in Europe was so dug in and so controlled by the oligarchy that there was almost no chance of that changing, CUSA came up with the idea of going west, finding a new place to start from, to bring new ideas, Republican ideas, back into Europe. And today, when we see the transatlantic collapsing, and as Tony described, an absolutely horrendous situation where human life is given no value, again, we're looking toward the West, this time toward Asia. To what extent does these ideas from Western philosophy of a republic and the general welfare, how is that reflected in China? Lainey?
Yes. I think the key ways it is reflected in China is through the influence earlier coming from the United States, from initiatives brought about by people like John Quincy Adams, in particular, to send missionaries from the United States over to Asia to counter the British Empire's efforts to control Asia. And simply to bring out, not so much just to Christianize people, but to get an idea of the basic principles of the United States to do good. And so we have seen very much in Japan, but very, very specifically in China, through a whole network where the most important and most famous was that of Sun Yat-sen, learning directly about the most crucial principles upon which America is founded, and using it in the fight, in the Sonia Sen's case, both to overthrow the Emperor of China, but also his in-depth economic development plan, and working on the three principles of the people, by the people, and for the people, which Sun Yat-sen himself said he got from directly from Lincoln. He'll repeat that again and again.
Didn't Sun Yat-sen, development plan take a lot from Lincoln's idea of how you use the Transcontinental Railroad to pull together the nation?
Yes. But also, he was very clear about, Sun Yat-sen was very clear about the British and the British role. When you had the Civil War beginning in China, and the efforts to split China up in two parts and then several parts, Sun Yat-sen sends a very sharp message to the United States, asking the United States to help. And he says that's exactly the situation that the United States was in with a Confederate South, supported by Britain, and industrialized North. And the idea was to split the United States up, and that's what they're trying to do with China at that point, Sun Yat-sen points out. So he calls for help. So now in the last period, also related to the question you had before, Harley, regarding how people are listening to LaRouche inside China, you have Sun Yat-sen has been taken up more and more. I mean, last here in the spring, a big picture of Sun Yat-sen was put on Tiananmen Square facing that of Mao, and he's being much more revived in the schools and so forth throughout China. So those are, and he took the most beautiful things from Chinese philosophy and paired that with the most beautiful from America. And I want to make a point here, because one of the things that many people don't think about at all, and that's one thing that I've had many, many discussions with Chinese people about, and in fact, we translated into Chinese Sun Yat-sen's book, The Vital Problem of China. Not translated, we got it published in Chinese, because it was not published because of the very sharp attack from Sun Yat-sen against the British. And I want to make a point, and that is that what we are facing today concerning war and destruction versus development, that is exactly what Kusa faced at his point, namely that the idea from the side of the empire is to split nations up, kill people, create wars, and sit outside and control the whole thing, where that of the ideas of the United States of the general welfare and thinking about the future generations and in-depth development of the whole continent of the United States and other nations abroad, that is anti-imperial, anti-oligarchical. That is the very essence of what the United States represent. This is what people like John Quincy Adams and Lincoln and others very much expressed, that this is our relationship to other nations, that the ideals upon which the United States was founded, that we all are born equal and with certain inalienable rights, that those inalienable rights are for everybody, every single baby on the globe. And that beginning to revive now Sun Yat-sen's ideas in China and beginning to be much more aware to what LaRouche represent because of the sharpening of the crisis, I think also will have a deep impact here in the coming weeks and months ahead regarding oligarchy, imperialism versus nation building and real republics.
Well, also because the killing policy is so open now in terms of the Obamacare. Also, you cannot look at the situation in Greece, or even, as you mentioned, Tony, shutting down of hospitals in Germany and bringing some of this private insurance nonsense from the United States into Germany. Now, I just want to shift a little bit in the focus here, and Tony, come back to you on this question of, you know, in spite of the pessimism that's induced by the greeny policy, the anti-human policy of the so-called environmentalists, there still are pockets of very advanced research going on in Europe. The ITER project on fusion is one. What can you tell us about the progress that's underway there?
Yeah, I think first of all, I would say also to get a positive outlook for Germany in there is we also have this great tradition of Leibniz that is directly related to your question, because as well the pursuit of happiness that's in the Declaration of Independence goes back to Leibniz, but also there's a big influence of Leibnizian ideas into China. I mean,
exactly.
He sent a lot of people into China that ended up translating Kepler into Chinese and a lot of other things. So I think we have to shift in Germany more to this Leibnizian identity, and then we can play actually a very important role. I mean, in September, there was already discussions between China and Europe, it's been particular France, to set up a fusion research center in France, to working more closely together in setting up the ITER, the big fusion reactor project in France, and having similar reactors with in China, what is a very, very good move. And there's already in November 2012, from the European Fusion Development Agreement, what was a law that exists since a couple of years, but they now, in November last year, published a study where they say, actually, we could do fusion until 2050 if we just start a little bit more investing to it. And in this agreement, there's already Japan involved, China involved, Russia is working in it. There's 28 nations in Europe working already on it. There's a little bit work from the United States also involved in that. So we could say the platform already exists for that, but the problem is the budget. Quantitative easing in Europe just destroys all the investments in it. So we in Germany now decided to put out a crash program for European fusion development, and we addressed scientists, engineers with it, and they're really happy about it. And we see that if we really start shifting policy, shifting paradigm to going east for Germany, working together with these Asian nations, going west, working together with the United States that shifted the policy outlook, we could establish fusion in 5 to 10 years or in 10 to maximum 20 years if we're really shifting our paradigm away from Wall Street, City of London, wars, geopolitics, into nation building, into helping each other.
Just for some of our listeners who aren't clear on what moving to a thermonuclear fusion economy would mean, what are some of the, besides the energy side, what would we gain from the research and the what impact would it have on physical economy?
Oh, that's a good question. I probably would answer it a little bit less direct, but I think it brings the point more across. If we're looking back in the history of our planet, I think we all can agree that the more a species could influence its environment, the more it is able to survive in a changing universe. So the only things that basically change over the time in history is that you get new species that work more efficient, they have a higher energy flux density, and they have a higher ability to change the environment. So from this standpoint, mankind is the only species that can have an evolution inside its own species. We don't need a next development to a next human being or something like that. We actually can transform our culture in a way that we're getting new economic platforms, that we get a higher energy flux density that operates our culture. And by this, we are being able to act more creatively in the environment that surrounds us. And from this standpoint, fusion is the next evolutionary step of mankind. With this technology, I mean, we're producing energy out of water that is much higher than nuclear fission, that's much, much higher than coal burning, oil burning, and so on and so forth. We would create power plants that for the first time will be not big water boiling machines. They would be actually able to create energy directly out of the fusion process. I think one of the most important and interesting things is the technology of a fusion torch, where we would be able to produce resources out of every material we can find, and the material which we can use only depends on the heat we can produce with the plasma or the ways we have to create an ionized gas that we call plasma. So at this point, it becomes totally clear that resources are nothing naturally giving, that's something that we create on the basis of our technological development of the energy flux density that our culture can use for the first. But if we then can create our own resources and don't depend on the things we can find in the earth and we can dig out, that would mean an end to resource wars. That would mean an end to the strange here and there stealing resources from other nations. That would be an end to the Henry Kissinger NSSM 200 doctrine of enslaving other nations to steal their resources.
What would you do, Tony, if this actually happened? What would you do about the depressed state of most Germans?
What I would do against the depressed state of the most Germans, communicating this idea, has made them excited about the possibilities we have in the future. And I think that's true, at least from my street experience, with people from all around the world. Everyone, Americans we meet, Europeans we meet, Africans we meet, Asian people we meet, they all see this great crisis for civilizations. And they become so, so happy when they see the other possibility that we have, the future
that could have. That was exactly my point, because if you think about what we're doing with these Schiller Institute New Paradigm Conferences, we've had several there in Germany. We may have another one coming up soon. We've had some in the United States, including the most recent in San Francisco and Los Angeles. And the idea is that, as we've been discussing with Confucius, with Sun Yat-sen, with Lincoln, with Leibniz and Kepler, Kuza, there's a universal human culture which is based on this idea of man advancing our own potential to exert power over the physical universe, and that's universal, and that's what's unleashed with the kind of technological and scientific optimism that you're discussing about a fusion program. And I think most Americans don't really know enough about China and Chinese culture to see that similar paradigm, but we had a very interesting presentation in San Francisco by your friend Victor, and I think it'd be useful just to talk a little bit about why his topic was U.S. and China, natural allies.
That goes to Confucius, who lived 100 years earlier than Plato. I regard him like the Plato of the East. And if you look in Confucius' writings, he says, for example, that the universe is lawfully ordered, that harmonic and lawfully ordered, and it constantly develops, and that the moon and the sun, they know where to go, and they never make a mistake because it's harmonically ordered. And then he says that every single man and woman is born with very specific capabilities, innate capabilities. And just when I'm going through this, think about the whole idea of the inalienable rights of man and the people like Leibniz and Kuza and so forth, the way they would talk about it. But Confucius says that we are born like as natural as our four limbs. We are born with these innate qualities, capabilities. And number one is love, a higher idea of love. And Confucius say that's the most important of our innate qualities. And you can have the other qualities, but if you don't have love, you have nothing. You can think about Paul's description of if you don't have charity, you're just empty, there's nothing. Mm-hmm. Then you have the other qualities being knowledge, love of knowledge, justice, love of justice, and so forth. But the most important thing is love. And then Confucius says, it is your duty as a human being to develop these capabilities to the utmost. And the only way you can do that is that you have to be absolutely truthful. You cannot be deceptive to yourself. You have to be absolutely truthful. And when you have developed these capabilities to the fullest, then you can, together with heaven and earth, participate in the creation process. And he develops very much in detail how this is functioning, also regarding the relationship, the social relationship in a society, and, for example, as it is expressed in music. That is, if you have a society, if you have the music that is ugly and violent and loud and lewd, then you have a society that is collapsing, and so forth. It's a very long, a very big subject for a few words. But if you think about what we held most dear concerning thoughts about man and man's relationship to the universe and the qualities of man. I mean, one thing also for Confucius is the question about the mind. Confucius was the known as the teacher, the philosopher, and to this day, you have on his birthday is celebrated throughout Asia, particularly in China, but throughout Asia as the Teacher's Day, because he functioned as the he was like the example of a great teacher.
You know, Lainey, I think we're probably going to have you back for a whole program on this, because it is quite fascinating, and it's something that Americans, if they actually understood that there was this commonality in terms of philosophical outlook, but also that Confucius is quite a profound thinker, that this would ease the process of this move toward the West. Now, I just want to conclude. We have about 8 minutes to go, and we did have at our Los Angeles event a final panel on John F. Kennedy and the what we lost with the assassination of John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. Lyndon LaRouche brought that up in his keynote, and he's been discussing that quite extensively in the last days. And, you know, Tony, John F. Kennedy had a special place in the hearts of Germans. I know you weren't around in 1963, but when he went to Berlin and gave his famous Ich bin ein Berliner speech, it thrilled people in Germany because it expressed this idea that the universal values of freedom in Berlin are the values of the whole West. Now, of course, we've seen a decline in culture and a collapse in culture. It's not the same Berlin that it was in 1961, but there really was a danger of war at that point with the building of the Berlin Wall and the confrontation between U.S. and Soviet tanks. What does the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of his assassination, what does that mean for people in Germany? Is there still a warm feeling about Kennedy and the United States from that time there?
It's interesting because from the standpoint of West Germany, of course, yeah, especially of West Berlin, you're finding these old people, they are getting a glimpse in their eyes when they're talking about the glorious Kennedy and how Kennedy helped the people actually to survive in West Berlin. But what I found actually much more interesting is the whole time period, because that also plays an important role for the East Germans, because they, of course, had not so much knowledge about Kennedy, but they knew that he worked together with people like, he was fighting also for the interests of people in Africa or people like Martin Luther King. And that was much clearer for the East Germans, too, that there was a president that was somehow totally different. And all the Germans, therefore, realized there was a great paradigm shift with the killing of Kennedy, but also with the killing of Martin Luther King, Kennedy's brother, but also the whole killing of the African Liberation Movement. That's kind of more in the East and gives a general overall picture for the Germans in the 60s. What we found interesting on the streets and also in the recent youth meeting conference that we had in Stuttgart was that this whole period of the 60s is very, very much in the mind also of the young people, because somehow everybody from a different angle realized that with the killing of Kennedy and what came afterwards, there was a paradigm shift, and a paradigm shift to a very, very bad paradigm. And so people were really thankful, helpful to get some insights with the recent interviews we did on Alpec TV, with the things that Lynn represented, with the articles that were published. So that's definitely a very, very important point, also for Germany.
Well, I think also this question that we're talking about, if people know something about that period, they also know that Kennedy's anti-colonialism was connected to his idea of bringing these new technologies, these more energy-dense technologies into Africa, including nuclear power, including his support for NOAAPA, the North American Water and Power Alliance. And perhaps if people have an honest reflection of what Kennedy represented, it would take on some of the greenie mentality, which Kennedy was definitely not a greenie. In fact, Kennedy gave a speech in Hanford, Washington, to inaugurate the opening of what at the time was the world's largest nuclear fission plant. And in his speech, he talked about nuclear energy as the great conservation policy because it would conserve other resources by creating electricity in such a dense way. So perhaps we can use this commemoration. We don't want people to be weepy and teary-eyed about a tragedy. The tragedy is what we've lost and what we've tolerated and allowed our nations to become. And in the last couple of minutes we have, I'd like to hear from both of you your thoughts on that. Lainey?
Yeah, because he represented, and again, the very best of the United States in being an anti-colonialist, anti-imperialist, and that is why he was assassinated. And I think that let that be for me, because that is why, between the lines, and people have this sense of him, that this is what he represented. He represented the real United States.
And I'll tell our listeners that Lainey, as a citizen from Denmark, is the most pro-American nationalist that I know. And it's because of people like Kennedy and John Quincy Adams, who you've studied extensively. Tony, what do you have any final thoughts on that?
Well, I think we should take the commemoration as a starting point for a new paradigm and taking up Kennedy's great work with the Freedom Corps to help other nations to develop, and take that as our new identity and just go in the future and make it better.
And just your thoughts, is it going to be possible to reverse the anti-nuclear paradigm in Germany?
Everything is possible because we did renaissances before in history, and so we have to do now in order to save mankind.
Ah, very good. So we still do have some optimistic Germans, don't we? Yeah, go ahead, Lainey.
No, because I thought about before when Tony talked about the fusion and what we can do. One thing that is extremely exciting in China now, and I've seen it grow over the last 10 years particularly, is an optimism. Simply people are being changed through the changes to being optimistic, living the changes that are taking place around them. Things are new roads, new cities, new railroads. Everything is changing. And people have a sense that there is a future. And that takes a life on its own. So as soon as we have Obama out and Glass-Steagall in and set on a course for development, it will take a life on its own. And I believe you can simply have a shift overnight concerning cultural outlook when people have an idea that there's a path forward and what that path is.
And the possibility of impeaching Obama is much greater now than ever, because people are beginning to experience that they've been sold a bill of goods on this insurance, the health bill, which is really an insurance bailout and a genocide policy. And we'll have to leave it at that. Tony, thanks very much for joining us. Lainey, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of work to do, because the impeachment of Obama and Glass-Steagall are the same issue, and if we get rid of Obama and get Glass-Steagall in, it will certainly change the situation in Germany. So thanks to both of you for joining us today. That's our program for this week, and we'll be back next week, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, with the next edition of The LaRouche Show.